humorous hacks. It's a medical podcast. We're going to teach you. We're going to teach you things.
Hello. Welcome to a very special episode of Humorous Hacks. It's me, Sarah, and I have a guest expert, on pediatric knowledge, the wonderful Tava, who has just come off a rotation in Alice Springs in the pediatric department.
Quite right.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
First time on.
First time.
How do you feel?
Good.
You pumped?
I am pumped.
You ready to talk about some pediatrics?
Yeah, well, it's when you said that I was a guestpert, that kind of sounded like a contradiction. Like, I'm a guessing expert as opposed to a guest expert. I don't know if that was intentional.
No, that's what I meant.
Oh, that's what you intended. Yeah, oh, that's what you meant. Yeah, didn't mean I was a guest expert.
No, I was... A guessing expert.
A guessing expert. Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's spot on then. Yeah. That's how I see myself.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Good.
Pretty much.
So today, we wanted to talk about causes of, like, acute shortness of breath in pediatric population.
Yeah.
So the topics I think we're going to cover today... and we'll split them up into acute shortness of breath and stridor, and acute shortness of breath and wheeze. So we're going to cover croup and a little bit of epiglottitis, and then talk about bronchiolitis and asthma, because when I was doing my pediatric rotation, the two main things I saw was bronchiolitis and croup, and they're just good viral ERTs that, like, are nice when you identify them and you can reassure the parents and be like, this is going to last 3 to 5 days. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you see much of that in Alice Springs?
I did. Well, I as I was flying out, the bronchiolitis boom was coming in. So we had a gastro boom. And amidst that boom, the kind of acute respiratory illnesses were trickling into.
Mm.
And definitely the point you said about parental concern was real in terms of questions like, is this something my kid's going to have forever?
Mm.
What are the long-term side effects of bronchiolitis?
Mm.
And that being really scary for them and something you can very easily address.
Yeah, and once you know how to, like, identify.
Yeah.
The ERTs, which is what we're going to try to convey today, because if you don't know, then everybody seems like whooping cough or like they've inhaled a foreign body and you're just like, ah, I don't know. I think it was great in the emergency department when you'd get those patients and you'd ask them how long they'd had the symptoms, and they'd say 3 days, or almost so many times they'd say 3 days, because when they're that viral ERT that gets worse on the third day lasts for about 5 days.
Yeah.
And they'd come in on the worst day, and then you could really, like, be like, it's going to get better from here. Like,
uphill from here.
Yeah, it's worse when they come in sick.
Yeah.
And it's day one, and you're like, oh, shit, you gotta... Let's keep you here.
Yeah.
Keep an eye on you. But when it's day three.
That was always a good discussion, also because the Alice Springs population was a bit different to what you might see in other hospitals in terms of... I think that it covers 1 million square kilometres.
Whoa.
It's huge. So the ability to send people home was significantly reduced. So it means that our threshold for admitting was lower.
This is probably going off topic, but, like, for international listeners, maybe you can give us an idea of what Alice Springs is your bed capacity and stuff.
So Alice Springs it's considered a remote town in Central Australian desert. So I actually don't know what the capacity of the hospital is, but it's covering a huge landmass area.
Mm.
And the inhabitants of that area are predominantly the Australian First Nation population. So Australian Indigenous peoples who are scattered throughout in small community groups, what is largely a arid land or a desert area, and would have to travel huge, huge distances to get into Alice Springs Hospital. So there's quite a strong connection between the Royal Flying Doctor Service and also, particularly in pediatrics, a very open communication between the pediatricians at the hospital and the remote nurses and doctors that are out scattered at some of the clinics. But what ends up happening is we anything that is bordering on being something gets sent to us. So it does, it means that what you're seeing and who you're seeing is different to what you would see in a metropolitan setting, and I think other rural settings too.
So interesting. Well, we'll talk about, we'll go through the conditions and then we can talk about like reasons for admission, which might be a bit different, but let's start. All right. So learning point number one.
Yes.
So a kid comes in with acute shortness of breath.
Yes.
The signs of shortness of breath would be increased respiratory rate. That one we know. And then you can sort of identify a kid who's struggling to breathe, but it's about knowing those signs of increased work of breathing, I think, that are particularly interesting.
Yes.
So, for example, the nasal flaring.
Really good for really young kids. Mm. Really can kind of, if it's a still kind of baby, check out that nose work.
because
it's a really good clue.
Yeah. And looking at their intercostals to see if the muscles between their ribs are drawing in when they take a breath in.
Yeah.
And then at their abdomen to see if they're sucking in their stomach to sort of like help them get that breath in.
Yes.
So those are three I can remember. Are there any more?
Well, I think there's also for an older kid, what position they're sitting in.
Mm.
So if the kid is leaning forward,
that tripod
positioning. Is there also, I want to say there's something to do with sternal?
I think the tracheal tug
is
another one. So seeing that recession there.
Yeah, that's coming to mind.
Yeah, which is, I found that really hard to remember as a medical student, and it's one of those lists that you learn and you don't think about, but when you're actually seeing quite a few kids come in with shortness of breath and you want to be able to not rely on their SATs, because SATs are important, but sometimes, you know, especially with those really little ones where they have to tape the SATs probe onto their big toe or something, you're not 100% focusing on that, and you want to be able to like look at them and think, does this child need, you know, supplemental oxygen straight away, and these are like the clues that you look at.
What's also really handy to have is a little card printout, which tells you, because the respiratory rate and what's considered the normal range changes with age. So just having that on your lanyard, you can kind of quick flip at and kind of eyeball the kid and think, ooh, like, where is this? Because that was very confusing in terms of vital signs. What is the acceptable range for heart rate, respiratory rate, blood pressure? All of these things are changing a lot, particularly in that 0 to 3 years old category. Yeah,
exactly. I remember trying to learn that in the medical thing, because I thought that was something I would be able to examine. And I can tell you now, that is not something worth memorizing.
Just print that out.
Put it on your lanyard. Move on. All right. So someone comes in with shortness of breath. So increased rest rate, these signs of increased work of breathing. They might have low saturation. And then it's what noise are they making? So the noises they could make usually fall into either a stridor or a wheeze.
Mm.
Or if they're silent, chest. That's another thing we'll talk about, but that's bad. So stridor is a sound that you make when you're inspirating, when you're inspiring.
Yes.
So it sounds like... Does that sound right?
Yeah, I wanted you to make the noise. I didn't want to try.
I'm always the one making the noise.
Yeah, so on inspiration, there's a sound being made, and it's more of...
And you can remember that because stridor has an I in it, I for inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of sound you're going to get with croup, because it's that upper airway inflammation, and also epiglottitis.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we won't talk about this today, but whooping cough also has that classic whoop sort of sound, as well as the cough, versus a wheeze, which is an expiratory sound. that's a tricky one. And sometimes you won't hear a wheeze so much without like listening to the stethoscope with your stethoscope.
Mm.
But once you listen to a few chests, you can really hear that expiratory noise,
mm-hmm.
which is classic of bronchiolitis
mm-hmm.
or asthma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, I feel like we could do a whole thing just on how to remember those two sounds.
But yeah.
We shall move on. So croup is one of the most common viral infections in young children mm-hmm. that causes stridor.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I started my pediatric rotation, they were doing one of those presentations and it was like really early on and I had read like one page of pediatrics and it was about croup
mm.
and they were asking, what is the formal name for croup? And everybody, it was one of those sessions where everybody's like being quiet, like nobody will answer the questions and it was taking forever. And I'm like, you know, screw it. I'm going to answer one just so we can get this ball rolling. And I was like, laryngotracheobronchitis. I actually think I had the notes in front of me at the time. And everybody was like, oh, good job.
Yeah.
So it's laryngotracheobronchitis, which basically means...
Mm.
Starting up in the larynx and the trachea, mm-hmm. all of that is inflamed rather than bronchiolitis, which just affects a small airways.
Yes. So this, as in when I was drawing kind of my diagram of upper respiratory tract infections, one good way of thinking about it is location. Mm-hmm. I found that a helpful tool for memory. And the other, I guess, kind of categorization is presentation of age of presentation. Mm. So if we look at croup and bronchiolitis, and we can say there's two distinct areas, and even with asthma, tending to affect the larger airways as opposed to the smaller ones, at least in the acute presentation. We can also say in terms of age of presentation, bronchiolitis 0 to 18 months, roughly croup
is like later on as well, so it's 6 months to 6 years. That's right.
6 months to
so
6 years.
That's how I remember bronchiolitis. I say 2 months to 2 years, and then croup 6 months to six years.
And with asthma, it's interesting because how do you distinguish between asthma and a viral induced wheeze?
Hmm.
Particularly if it's a first presentation.
Yeah, this is actually, I wanted to save this for later, but let's talk about it now.
Jumping the gun.
No, because I think it's really interesting because all these kids come in with viral induced wheeze.
Yeah.
Which is the better way to say it, which is usually bronchiolitis of some sort.
Yeah.
And then if they're responsive to like salbutamol, then they get labeled as asthma, even though they're too young to technically sort of have asthma, and it's like this interesting gray area.
Well, I guess the things you want to think about in terms of what distinguishes asthma from a viral induced wheeze is chronicity, recurrence. So could you possibly make a diagnosis of asthma based on a single presentation? I would argue no.
Yeah, I would agree.
So the responsiveness to salbutamol becomes a little bit redundant in the context of a first presentation.
Yeah.
And so it's much more about longevity and tracking this individual patient and seeing, well, are there triggers aside from viral illness? And what is the severity of the present, of like the, I guess, the airway restriction? So I think definitely shying away from using the term asthma.
Yeah, it's always better. Because those labels get stuck.
Yeah. And particularly, again, in the parent's mind. And you want to be really careful of what you're telling parents and how they are, I guess, constructing the image of their child's health status.
Let's jump back to croup.
Yeah.
Because we're going to lose track of where we are. Okay, so croup is upper airway sort of inflammation. It's a viral illness. The most common virus that causes croup in Australia is parainfluenza,
mm-hmm.
which I can't think of a good way to remember, but like para, you can think maybe like around the vocal cords. So surrounding the vocal cords, para influenza. I don't know if you like that, you can have it. And they come in with this stridor. Also other, you know, viral irty features, coryza, which some people don't use the word coryza, but having runny nose and like...
It's like the good cold symptoms.
Yeah, all those cold symptoms, you can sound fancy and call them coryzal symptoms. And then you get that typical barking cough, which I remember because I had it when I was young. I had a bark. My mum always said, yeah, you have a bark. So I had croup. And I remember like doing this seal's bark. I was like, I can't really do it now, but it was like very distinct.
Wow.
And like when I'd breathe out.
How old were you?
I think I was maybe 6 or something, which is right in memory. Right in the age. But the reason I remember is because it was the first time I watched E.T. and I remember being in my mum's like big bed and I felt like it was like floating because I was like really unwell and I don't know what medication I was on, but like it felt like it was going up and down. I was like watching E.T. and it was like a very distinct memory.
Wow.
Yeah. So 6-year-old Sarah with croup.
There we go.
And how do you manage it? So number one is don't mess with a kid with croup.
Yeah.
Because their airways are already so swollen and you don't want them, if they start crying, you can imagine it would make everything a lot worse, particularly in these patients.
Yeah.
So that's the big thing. Minimal handling. Keep medical students away from the kid with croup. Unless they have bubbles. That's my thing. I wouldn't say that. I think everyone should have a go as a child with croup. But you don't jab them. You don't put in a cannula. You don't do anything like that. You just try to keep them calm.
Yeah.
Turn on Frozen. Or Moana. I don't know what's in vogue nowadays.
Just go Lion King. Just go for gold.
I don't know. Lion King's a bit... And then you can give them steroids.
So what are the indications for giving steroids?
That's a good question. What would you say?
Severity. I'd say like prolonged like severity and I guess prolonged illness. But in terms of the specific, I can't remember from the top of my head.
I think it's one of those things that's very case-to-case based.
Yeah.
Like what we were saying, if it was a kid day one who's coming in with stridor, you'd probably be more inclined to start them on some prednisolone. Whereas if it's day three and it's quite mild and their work of breathing isn't so severe and they don't look like they've been working hard for a few days. Because that's the other thing with work of breathing is that after a few days in a little kid who's also had poor feeding, which is a whole separate thing about feeding and wet nappies, then your threshold for treatment is lower. But the medical management is 1 mg/kg of oral prednisolone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can give other stuff, but that's what I remember in Australia. I call it ready pred, and you just like chuck them on some ready pred. And you always get kids who come in with bronchiolitis who have been given ready pred for 3 days, and you're like, so frustrating. But yeah, and so aside from that medical management, everything else is just supportive. They don't need antibiotics. They don't need salbutamol and other stuff like that because it's upper airway. And you just make sure they're well hydrated, that they've got painkillers on board. You can step it up to dexamethasone if you need a stronger anti-inflammatory.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd probably start on oral pred.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good old orals.
And if it's not croup, like if you've got a kid who comes in and they are what they call toxic looking.
Yes.
Which is funny. I think once you see photos or like see kids like that, you get it. But like until then, you're like, what does toxic look like? And basically it's like stridor plus they are floppy and they're like keeping their necks in weird positions because they need to keep their airway open and they're drooling because they're also not swallowing. And that's all the signs of epiglottitis. And on the exam questions, it's always like, this kid comes in with a barking cough that, you know, day three, and they make it sound really croupy. And then they're like, and there's a patch of drool on mum's shoulder. And you're like, ding, 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 epiglottitis. And epiglottitis is caused by Haemophilus influenza B, which is the one that everybody gets vaccinated for.
It's good old jab.
Good old jab.
Mm.
And as soon as you see that, you definitely don't let the junior doctors involved. And you get...
you escalate.
You escalate straight away.
Do what you do best.
Yeah, yeah.
Escalate.
Call a med call. Hit that button. And they might even require intubation, so it's a big deal.
It's serious stuff.
Serious stuff. So always look for that drool. I don't know how much that applies to real life, but...
Yeah.
Certainly for exam prep.
And I guess in terms of just talking around it, also within the age of presentation, 6 months to 6 years, you think about inhaled or a foreign body.
Mm-hmm.
So if the kid is like looking pretty well otherwise, definitely not that toxic picture.
Mm.
No clear chorizal symptoms preceding, no viral illness preceding. All of a sudden, they've just got some chest downs happening.
Yeah.
Foreign body.
Yeah. You're worried about that.
Yeah.
And that's also what the exam questions look like. They're like, sudden onset of acute shortness of breath, following playing with his Lego toy. Yeah. Something like that. And you're like, but he's drooling, but he was just playing with Lego. I don't know which one to choose.
Mum has a patch of drool on her shoulder. Yes.
And I've got some great photos from this year of kids who have like swallowed coins and that like it's we may as well talk about foreign bodies, but like it sits in the trachea, and if it's like if it looks like a coin, like it's facing you, you feel better because that means that
it's not occluding.
It can't be completely occluding the airway. Whereas if you got an x-ray of a kid who'd swallow a coin and you could only see like a that slam. Thin slice, you'd be like, ah!
Escalate.
That's the whole role of junior doctors. Seriously, that's actually a whole thing, like knowing when to escalate.
Yeah.
That is when. Cool. So we've covered causes of stridor, which all happen to be in the 6 months to 6 year old age. Yeah. So croup is 6 months to 6 years, epiglottitis is the same age, and kids who can get their hands on stuff and putting it in the mouth is also about 6 months to 6 years. And now we can go on to causes of wheeze, which we've already touched on. So
bronchiolitis. So 0 to 18 months, you got a baby, nasal flaring's happening all over the place. Definitely also because particularly the younger they are, it can get really hard to listen to their chests because their heart sounds, when you're inexperienced, can overpower their chest sounds. So it can be a difficult assessment, but looking for those work of breathing signs, listening to the parent who's bringing the little one in about behavior changes, how are they feeding? Usually feeding has gone way, way, way down because they're expending all of their energy on just trying to breathe. They're not really... taking in food, so you're also doing an assessment of dehydration, and asking the parent around wet nappies, and that's also a really good indicator of severity. So it's really important to know when was the last meal, did they keep it down, did they vomit it up, and so in your exam, kind of doing, I guess, as thorough a general inspection as possible. And then, from my understanding, the course of bronchiolitis can be a bit more protracted than croup. So it can really... It can go up to 2 weeks. It can be quite an extended presentation. And when you're considering, at least in Alice Springs, reasons for admission... were very much centered around how hard was that kid working? Did they need support in order to work? And what was their fluid intake? Did they need a nasogastric tube put inside them so that they could actually get given a little bit of energy to keep on working? Or were they tolerating oral feeds? So for a kid who was working really hard, not tolerating oral feeds, for us that was a reason to admit. And then on admission, it was, getting the nasogastric tube in, deciding what other supportive therapy they might need, and educating parents was also a big part of it to not freak out too much. This was a really, really common, common presentation, and one that usually resolves with no sequelae. And yeah, the extended course of it can also be a little bit disconcerting.
One of the other things that I'm sure is really upsetting for parents is seeing like the apneic episodes that you can get
in
bronchiolitis, because they'll stop breathing for a minute, and that will usually send any parents running to hospital.
Yes.
It's scary when you see them working so hard for so long. And that's when you come to like supportive therapy, like oxygen. So often they'll get nasal prongs, but they might have to go up to high flow nasal prongs.
Mm.
And then if that doesn't work, then they might need CPAP. So, you know, even more. And then they'll probably have to go into a high dependency unit. And then worst case, they'd have to be intubated, which can be very distressing for everyone involved.
As a junior doctor, I think deciding you're not the one to make the decisions about how they need oxygen delivered, or it's kind of, if you're encountering the child in the ED, you just want to know, does this child need to be admitted? Do they need to be seen by someone a little bit more knowledgeable than you, who's had experience with this? And being able to tell, to be able to assess, like, how unwell is this child at the moment.
Exactly. And one good tip is always trust the parents.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they'll know what's not normal for their child.
Yeah.
So the most common cause of bronchiolitis is, as we said, these are mostly viruses, and it's RSV, which is respiratory syncytial virus,
tricky one,
which is the one which has respiratory in it.
So yeah,
we said croup before was para influenza, because it's para around sort of the vocal cords, and then bronchiolitis is a more of a respiratory illness, so it's an RSV, and it affects like the lower, like we said, sort of like more airway, the lower airways. For in terms of like investigating these kids, I think most times you could probably assume it's bronchiolitis from the clinical picture. You could do a chest x-ray, and then you'd see that, like, really those hyperinflated lungs, because they're working really hard, and you might see some like atelectasis, so lung collapse and consolidation. And then I guess if the consolidation is really bad, you might start thinking about other causes like pneumonia. But most of the time, I don't think you have to go down that path.
No, and in terms of exposure to radiation, it's not really warranted. Like, at times we did a finger prick to do a blood gas. And so you're thinking of things of metabolic acidosis, respiratory acidosis, based on the increased work of breathing. How's their little biochemistry going? Have they hit an acidosis because they're working so hard, and does that need management? That's something you can consider if you think the kid is really sick. Otherwise, not too much of an indication for investigation. Any of these presentations, really.
Yeah, because it's mostly supportive management. So investigations don't really guide supportive management. You're mostly focusing on feeding and fluids and oxygen saturation. For bronch, you can try stuff if you're, like, desperate, like salbutamol and steroids. And, you know, saline nebulizers. But they're not clearly indicated. It's just more like they've got a really bad cold and they're really small. So you want to do the equivalent of giving them a cup of tea and, like, keeping an eye on them.
Yeah. But I guess you raised a good point, because that age group can also present with pneumonia. So in terms of distinguishing between pneumonia and bronchiolitis... Tricky. And that's where... I know for us, with the little ones, being more experienced with listening to chest and being able to hear reduced air entry in certain parts, particularly as the kids are getting a bit older. So bronchiolitis, again, it wasn't so it's difficult. Mm. It's just difficult.
Yeah.
But, and also with pneumonia, looking more closely at vital signs like temperature mm. and white cell count and, does it sound like a wet, mm. phlegmy cough
mm.
that's being produced? Mm. Because they won't bring up phlegm mm. at that age. That's something I learned. They don't have the capacity to actually bring it out.
Yeah.
So something to keep in the back of your mind if it's, and that was definitely true of our population because, of, I guess, conditions that they're living in,
mm.
that they can be exposed to pathogens that will more likely, and prolonged exposure that could lead to a pneumonia mm. as opposed to a bronchiolitis.
Mm.
And then again, imaging would be helpful in that circumstance
yeah.
in terms of demonstrating patchy changes.
And you could also do a nasopharyngeal aspirate if
yes.
you were suspicious of that, which I remember when I started, another thing yeah. that I started on peds, and it'd always be like NPA, and I like never got around to asking what it was until very late. And so that's like it's basically a swab, a nasopharyngeal swab,
yes.
That you can grow viruses on. So if you've got an RSV on that, maybe you'd feel more confident. But if not, then you could try to culture some sort of mucus.
Yes.
And try to figure out what else it is. And especially for kids who are at high risk, so ones who were born premature or have like immunodeficiency of some cause of another or congenital heart disease, then you're starting to get more worried and like, again, you would escalate.
Yep.
And those kids...
That's a really good point.
Yeah, and if they're getting recurrent bronchiolitis or even just once and it really knocks them about, you could consider doing some preventative management for them so they can get antivirals.
Mm-hmm.
Like to stop this
mm-hmm.
occurring, because as soon as you put the kids in daycare, they're gonna start getting sick. That was like what all the families got told. It's like they feel like, you know, oh, this is the third time, you know, this month or something. It's like, well,
daycare.
Yeah, daycare.
You like signed in for this.
It's a breeding ground, which is interesting. And then what we were talking about before, so if they're slightly older or if they're present their recurrent presentations with this wheeze,
yeah,
maybe it's asthma.
Mm.
So asthma is again an inflammation of the small airways. It causes a wheeze, but the main thing is that it's reversible, so bronchiolitis is not going to be easily reversed.
Mm-hmm.
It's gonna go on like a viral illness does.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas asthma, you know, if it's, especially if it's got a good bronchodilator response, which it usually does, then
mm-hmm.
you give them some Ventolin and they're like, I can breathe. Is my summary. You were just saying before that you felt like an asthmatic when you go running in the cold.
Yeah, you just get this like, whew, this knockout in your chest as you breathe in this really cold air and gasp for breath, and I'm like, wow, I think this is what asthma feels like. To which you responded, no, that is asthma. What asthma feels like, but I think it's what asthma you feels know. Like.
Tab refuses to accept that she may have asthma.
But it's, I guess some key things with asthma management is that same work of breathing is going to be evident. And particularly if the kid begins to mobilize and start to do things,
mm.
the wheeze will worsen.
Mm.
So the wheeze isn't stable. It can worsen, it flare up depending mm. on the amount of activity the kid's doing. And there's the whole idea of stretching. So you...
Yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah, so after you administer the first Ventolin or salbutamol dose, you're trying to gauge how long can this kid last without needing another dose.
Mm.
And you want to be comfortably stretching them, I think, to 3 or 4 hours before discharge.
Yeah.
And giving the parents really good education on how to administer the Ventolin is really, really yeah. important.
So we could definitely do a whole episode on asthma, and we probably should do because it's extensive.
Yeah.
But to summarize, I guess we'll say that asthma is, it can be triggered by viral illnesses, but it is mm-hmm. not in itself. It's a viral illness. It's a hypersensitivity of the airways.
Yeah.
By, that is triggered by certain things. So my way of remembering what triggers asthma is actually from when I was on a camp,
mm.
leading a youth camp with, and I was the medic, and it was up in the mountains, freezing cold. We had wood fires going, and there were obviously sick kids around. So we had, you know, cold triggers. We had smoke, dust, pollen, absolutely everything that you could.
And the kids were probably running around doing a lot of activity.
Exactly. And we had maybe two known asthmatics. And by the end, I had treated about 10 kids, which is crazy because it was like a storm. It was literally like an asthma storm, which that happened. Oh, yeah, that happened.
Hey, I take the asthma storm.
Sorry.
That over the gastro storm that I got.
I don't know. I think I got. They're both bad.
Out of both ends.
I think I'd rather have a gastro storm in a hospital than an asthma storm by yourself with two puffers.
No, so. I meant when I was medic on a camp.
Oh, you
I got a gastro storm. Oh, yeah, and then we had to make the call that we need to shut down the camp or could it continue because the number of like kids and leaders rolling in
that is
like shocking. Vomiting and diarrheaing went through the roof and it was just me. And it was
I've had to do that before and it's like fully like isolation and hydrolyte. It's like you find the sick
do
people,
not touch this is them, your corner.
Yeah, you separate
you do
them.
Not go into the food room. Not have dinner.
And then you like force them to drink the hydrolyte, which I never do, which I don't understand because it's delicious. Anyway, so asthma, all these triggers. You get them to use this. You have to use a spacer for young kids. Spacers are amazing. Just use them every time. Don't worry about not using them.
Yeah.
They're really easy. And yeah, so you give them a salbutamol and you see, basically you just keep giving it to them as needed.
Yeah.
The side effects can be that they'll become tachycardic and they can get like shakes.
Mm-hmm.
So you obviously you don't want to give them that much, but I'm not actually sure about the specific guidelines of how.
Like the 4 puffs or 6 puffs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every... Like, initially you're doing it when there's severe presentation, you're doing, I think, 3 rounds at 20 minutes. Is that right? From the top of my head?
So, how I remember it is less than 6 years old, you give them 6 puffs.
Yeah.
Straight off the bat.
Yeah.
And more than 6 years old, you give them 12 puffs. But I usually like to do, like, 4 or into a spacer and then wait, and you do that 3 times.
Yeah.
That's how I did it anyway.
Yeah.
So you want some sort of routine like that where you give them a specific amount,
mm-hmm.
then you wait, and
mm-hmm.
then you see how long it takes until they need more.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, you can decide how to escalate. And again, escalation is usually not the junior doctor's role, but you can give them supplemental oxygen. You can give them Atrovent.
Yeah.
So that's ipratropium,
mm-hmm.
which is an anti-muscarinic.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard thing to remember
because
there's tiotropium as well, which is like the long-acting one.
The lava, yeah.
The
Lama, not lava. Lama.
Okay, so salbutamol is a SABA, a short-acting beta agonist. Atrovent or ipratropium, which is ip, so it's short,
mm-hmm.
short-acting anti-muscarinic, so
mm-hmm.
working on different receptors in the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's long-acting beta agonists,
mm-hmm.
like efumaterol, I think, is
one
of them.
Yeah, good pronunciation.
And then long-acting anti-muscarinics, like tiotropium.
Yeah.
It's a bit longer than ipratropium. That's how I'm going to remember it today. And then you can also give them steroids as well if you're, like, really desperate. And then there's other stuff, which is, like, IV salbutamol, aminophylline. I don't know what that does. And then, of course, the be-all, end-all of any treatment, which is magnesium sulfate. IV magnesium. It's just like, what? Which is a muscle relaxant.
I know. It just does so many wonderful things.
Magnesium's amazing.
Yeah.
I take magnesium for my muscles.
It's great. I don't.
Maybe I should just hook it up to my veins.
It's like a daily dose. Cool. So I think the last thing which I guess I'll briefly mention is something that I'd never seen before called chronic suppurative lung disease. And what it is essentially, it's bronchiectasis without radiological proof. Mm-hmm. So bronchiectasis being irreversible airway damage, as evidenced by two high-resolution CT scans, that's establishing the fact that it's irreversible, that you've detected it on one CT scan, and then when you CT scan again, it's still there. And in bad situations, that it's worsened. So CLSD, chronic suppurative lung disease, is irreversible airway damage without that radiological, like, proof.
Ah.
And that happens for a few reasons. One, because they're super young. Two, in our population, in Alice Springs, their itinerant, like, doing one CT scan and then trying to get someone back for a second one.
Right.
Just to confirm that there's been irreversible airway damage seems a little bit redundant. And because the confirmation happens and you see this, that there are just recurrent presentations. Mm. So there are kids who are just coming in every 2 or 3 months with really serious airway disease.
Mm.
And you know on their x-rays that they're really unwell. Mm. And the frequency of the I guess the recurring presentation is indication that the structural damage is taking place, which is making them more susceptible to pathogens that perhaps would not present, or just like recurring pneumonia that doesn't quite ever clear. And it's really distressing, to be honest, because these kids are so young and we don't know yet, I guess, the long-term consequences of having such significant damage to your airways at such a young age. You can hypothesize that we're going to see a lot of premature death within this population. That was what the head of the unit and the consultants are predicting in 20, 30 years' time, that these kids who have come in 1, 2, 3 years old, just every other month, are going to really struggle as adults. So that was new and very confronting to see. And there's, in terms of management, there's role for long-term antibiotics and education around, I guess, prevention, kind of those things that you were talking about as exposure for asthma, but being in environments where there's like high density of people, a lot of smoke, these things that are going to increase your likelihood of catching a respiratory illness. So trying to educate around that, but also while acknowledging that there's a limit to medical education when the problem is structural and political and well beyond just the medical arena alone. So it also meant that there were certain patients who we knew and we would admit immediately because of their history, and I guess that speaks to what you were saying before about always thinking with any patient that might have an underlying illness, be that something like cystic fibrosis or whatever it may be, lowering your threshold for admission, because severity is likely to be to be increased.
Yeah, so I was saying when Taylor brought this up that I haven't actually heard or learned much about chronic suppurative lung disease, but it does sound like that sort of, like, a cystic, when you have someone with cystic fibrosis and they just, like, keep getting those infections and it leads to the destruction of the airways, or, like, chronic suppurative otitis media, I think, is one.
Yeah, also like, something
that
a lot of our population had, leading to irreversible hearing damage.
So
it's that same kind of chronic exposure to viruses and bacteria, leading to chronic infection, leading to irreversible damage.
Which I guess is a good point to make, that early education for parents it can only be a good thing. Like, I'm sure for lots of these patients, once they've come in, like, they've come in one or two or three times and maybe not gotten that message or gotten that sort of education. And that, like, not, I'm not saying that that's a cause, but, like, that can't help. So always good to talk to your parents and take that extra time to educate and talk about risk factors and prevention and stuff. And then it all comes back to prevention and how important that is. And
except the prevention in this case is
much bigger the parents. Yes.
And so, 200 years of trauma and abuse.
And that's a topic for another day that we should really, I'm not trying to stop us going into it, but we should talk more about Indigenous populations and
health approaches.
And health approaches.
Yeah.
In a multi-faceted, it's probably not the right word, political way, maybe. Anyway.
I will plug, if anyone is interested in reading around, I guess, Indigenous pediatric health, there is an incredible book called Beyond the Social Determinants of Health. And it's specifically in relation to the pediatric population and has a really interesting discussion on Indigenous approaches to parenting and the role of the child, which is really, really different to, I guess, the mainstream Western culture that I've grown up in. Mm. And I found that discourse absolutely fascinating. Because it completely challenges the way that you interact with a child. Mm. So that's an excellent, excellent book to read.
Awesome. What was it called again?
So Beyond the Social Determinants of Health.
And really, really rolls off the tongue.
I know. And it's pediatric. Maybe chuck in pediatric word while you're trying to do that. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the author at the moment, but I'm pretty sure he's a pediatrician who's worked with the Indigenous community for many, many, many years.
Awesome.
And I know that it came highly recommended from the head of the unit at Alice Springs Hospital, so that's how I got my way onto it. Yep.
Tava, thanks so much for coming in and just being like a boss and expert of all the guests we've had. You are our Indigenous pediatric health expert.
By virtue of my one placement, I think we'll stick with guestpert on that one.
Definitely our best guestpert so far. So now we're done. Now we'll do our study hacks. I've thought of one just throughout the course of this podcast, and then you can do one so you can think while I say mine.
Great.
Mine would be, and this is a personal regret I've had from medical school, listen to every chest because you're often tasked with writing notes, and there'll be lots of patients around who get their chest listened to by the other doctors, and it takes 2 seconds for you to pop on your stethoscope, if you haven't lost it, which I've lost mine right now, to put on your stethoscope and just have a listen while they're already in that position.
Yeah.
You know, even if the doctor's listening on one side and you're listening on the other side, it is invaluable because you want to hear normal and you want to hear abnormal. And I've recently listened to...
And you also want to hear your patient. So when you're
sorry. We're actually just talking about study hacks. We're not talking about patient-centered care at the moment. No, yeah, exactly. You want to hear your patient because you want to know how they're changing. Exactly.
And that's really hard when you haven't listened and the senior doctor asks you, have they improved or worsened?
Yeah,
and you're like, couldn't tell you.
There are crackles somewhere. So I recently listened to a chest with lung fibrosis and those fine inspiratory crackles or crepitations that you get, and how different they are from a chest with a wheeze or pneumonia. And like, that's kind of shit that this is the first time I've ever heard that, because I've certainly seen other patients, but I've never been very forward about listening to chests. So I would make that my recommendation. Do you have a study hack?
A study hack specifically for
pediatrics? No. You can think about anything.
I would say... in terms of where my greatest learning opportunities came was from shadowing the senior registrars as they were doing admissions. And that was great because you saw the acute presentation as opposed to by the time they've come out of ED and they've already been stabilized. So if you can get your foot in to that initial assessment, it's really, really good because you actually see all the symptoms as opposed to like reading the symptoms and it's like, oh, well, this kid's already been given their Ventolin
and,
like, they're breathing fine or whatever, they're on oxygen and they're, So my study hack would be get in for the admissions.
That's actually a really good point. I think in medical school you assume that every patient interaction is going to be a full, you know, OSCE style head top to toe history of presenting complaint all the way down to social history and everything. And usually 90% of your patient interactions are just like a check-in where that's all been done before.
Yeah.
And the best admissions are ones that are that medical student level of thoroughness.
Yeah.
So it's really good to get in on. And I was always I kind of get intimidated when people ask me to do an admission, but actually it's the best place. It's like you're actually quite well trained for it because it's that really thorough.
Just taking all your systems covered.
Yeah, all systems. You take your time. You don't have to worry about making.
And that's it. Usually an admission could be like an hour. Like you go slow and you do a full physical examination.
Yeah.
Which is also big in the pediatric population in terms of like checking the.
Because they're so little. You just look at everything.
Yeah, like things are growing and you're just looking, just look.
Yeah, it's broad. But admissions are good.
Yeah.
Don't be scared of them because you just go back to, I hate it when people say that, back to basics. But literally you revert back to your instincts, which is to cover everything and not jump forward to like one conclusion or one diagnosis.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming. This has been super fun.
Technically, you came to me. So.
I came to you. We have gone well over time.
I was about to say,
it's been delightful. And now should we do like a little outro doodad?
Yeah, let's go for it.
What we usually say
is,
I don't know if you've listened. She hasn't. I know she hasn't. She's never gone through an episode. What we say is, don't stress. And then you say it as well.
All right.
Okay, go.
Don't stress.
Woo!
Humorous hacks. It's a medical podcast. We're gonna teach you. We're gonna teach you things.